You're listening to KPFA 94.1 in Berkeley, KPFB 89.3 in Berkeley, and KFCF 88.1 in Fresno.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, November 2nd, 2016. This is Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks here with Mitch, my friend Jezrich.
Did you get any emails about that?
I haven't gotten any, y'all. Okay. Kat at KPFA.org.
That's definitely an affirmative.
What should we be calling
now, Mitch? Now, today was very kind. Today is very kind. But like I said, I'm afraid I'm going to have some investigators pretty soon showing up to my door.
This is consequences of the role of a meme.
Yeah, I know that. I mean, like I said, you know, suddenly I noticed cars and vans following me as I walk by.
Welcome to my world. This morning, Mitch, what are we talking about this morning?
Well, Kat, this is something that you're actually very familiar with. Yeah. Sergeant, it's a case concerning Sergeant James Gant, and he was a lead homicide investigator, and he's now a whistleblower, and something you're very much connected to. We're going to be talking a lot more about this, including to his attorney, Dan Siegel. We'll be talking to you, and we'll be going through all what this is all about.
Yep, and on the second half of the show, we continue our election coverage with a conversation with Jeff Chang, who is the executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford, about the political climate, this election cycle, and where we go from here.
Man, less than a week away.
Less than a week away.
And I'm a fan of Jeff Chang.
Me too. Yeah, he's awesome. Good. That's all next, after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfenderry with KPFA News Headlines. President Obama says federal officials are considering whether it's possible to reroute the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. Obama spoke to Now This.
My view is that there is a way for us to accommodate sacred lands of Native Americans. And you know, I think that right now the Army Corps is examining whether there are ways to reroute this pipeline in a way.
Right.
So we're going to let it play out for several more weeks and determine whether or not this can be resolved. In a way that I think is properly attentive to the traditions of the first Americans.
The Standing Rock Sioux tribe and supporters have staged a weeks-long protest and encampment against the pipeline. They say it threatens to contaminate water supplies and disturb burial sites. More than 400 people have been arrested since August at the North Dakota portion of the pipeline. It also crosses through South Dakota, Iowa, and Illinois. North Dakota leaders yesterday agreed to borrow an additional $4 million to cover the escalating costs of law enforcement. Officials slammed the federal government for not chipping in for part of the funding for law enforcement at the Dakota Access Pipeline. An Oakland police officer is suing the city, the Oakland Police Department, and Mayor Libby Schaaf, saying they retaliated against him for investigating another police officer who may have killed his own wife. And to deflect attention from allegations that Oakland police officers sexually exploited a young woman then known as Celeste Guap, Christopher Martinez filed this report from Oakland.
The twisted saga of the Oakland Police Department has taken a new turn. It's a complicated story that involves allegations of police officers involved in sex trafficking and statutory rape, and now claims the Oakland police are retaliating against a whistleblower in a murder cover-up.
I'm just tired of being made out to be the scapegoat.
Police Sergeant James Mike Gant interrogated Officer Brendan O'Brien in the death of O'Brien's wife. Officer O'Brien later committed suicide, triggering the events that brought to light the sex abuse scandal involving a young woman then known as Celeste Guap. Sergeant Gant says he thought the death of O'Brien's wife was not a suicide, as it was later ruled, but a murder committed by Officer O'Brien. But he says he was pulled off the case for pushing too hard in the interrogation of a fellow police officer.
As you all know, the thin blue line is alive and well, you know, and once you step over that line, then you become an outcast, which obviously I've stepped over the line because they haven't brought me back to work.
Gant was placed on administrative leave amid complaints he was involved in a domestic dispute with his wife and allowed an acquaintance to transcribe confidential materials from an investigation. Gant and his lawyers say that was retaliation for Gant's murder investigation and also a ploy to deflect attention from the charges of police involvement in sexually exploiting Celeste Guap. Gant has filed a complaint against the city, naming the City of Oakland, Mayor Libby Schaaf, the city administrator, and police officials, saying they violated his rights and retaliated against him. Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf's office says it is legally barred from disclosing personnel information about any police officer and does not comment on pending litigation. Reporting from Oakland, I'm Christopher Martinez.
More on this story on Upfront immediately following this newscast. In Iowa, two Des Moines area police officers were shot to death early this morning in separate ambush-style attacks. Des Moines Sergeant Paul Parasek said they were shot while sitting in their patrol cars.
These officers were ambushed. On the surface right now, just like I said, we're just a few hours into this. It doesn't look like there was any interaction between these officers and whoever the coward is that shot them while they sat in their cars. That's the best we got that we can explain the scene right now. Both of them were in their cars.
Police said they're searching for a known suspect and circulated a photo of a 46-year-old white man, Scott Michael Green. Hillary Clinton campaigns in Arizona and Nevada today. Yesterday, she was in Florida with former Miss Universe Alicia Machado, who recalled the times Clinton's rival, Republican Donald Trump, called the Venezuelan-American Miss Piggy and other slurs.
He told me that I looked ugly and I was massive. He even called me names. He said to me, Miss Piggy, Miss Housekeeping, Miss Sitting Machine. It was really painful for me. He was cruel. For years afterwards, I was sick, fighting back eating disorders.
Clinton slammed Trump's ethics, calling out the numerous times he made charged and controversial statements about women, prisoners of war, a Latino judge, the Muslim parents of a soldier who died in battle, and Trump's exploitation of undocumented immigrants. Trump campaigned with running mate Mike Pence in the battleground state of Pennsylvania. He spoke out against Obamacare and Hillary Clinton's support for it.
The president said, if you like your plan, you can keep your plan. If you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor, which may go down as one of the great political lies of the century.
Trump said if elected, he'll immediately convene a special session of Congress to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. California's Prop 64 to legalize the recreational use of marijuana is ahead by 17 percentage points in the latest poll by the Public Policy Institute of California. San Jose has become the latest city in the state to act to approve a temporary ban on recreational marijuana sales. The city council voted unanimously yesterday to impose the ban. The Mercury News reports San Jose officials say the moratorium will give them time to come up with new rules complying with the terms of Prop 64. They're worried about recreational marijuana shops springing up otherwise. The report says city officials indicated the ban would remain in effect until at least 2018, when the state plans to begin licensing recreational marijuana stores. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, sunny, highs around 70. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, a dense fog advisory in effect until 11. Haze in the afternoon, high 69 to 74 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news on 94.1 at 7:30.
It is just about 7:09 in the morning. You are listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks here with Mitch Jezrich.
Yeah. That's who I am.
Good morning, Mitch.
Good morning to you, Kat. Good morning to everyone. So, Kat, this morning's going to be an important segment that we are doing. And I think as many people know, you wear and you have a lot of things going on in your life. You're a broadcaster here on KPFA. You're also a longtime activist in the community. You're also an actor and all these other things. But today we're going to put on your activist hat a little bit because you are very, and we want to be very clear about this and upfront, no pun intended, that you are very involved in a very important story, here locally in Oakland. And that is, yesterday, 27-year veteran of the Oakland Police Department, Mike Gant, Sergeant Mike Gant, came out and has accused the Oakland Police Department and also the city government of retaliating against him for some of his investigations within the police department that he has done. This is something that you're very much involved in, not only because you're very involved in policing issues in Oakland, but also your organization, the Anti-Terror police or anti-police.
I really should have listened to people when they told me not to use that name. Anti-Police Terror Project.
I should have wrote it down.
APTP.
Yes. So that's the organization. You set up a hotline for whistleblowers.
The organization, so I want to say it's not ICAT who's very involved. The organization Anti-Police Terror Project is involved, and primarily through the legal arm of our organization, which is through Dan Siegel and Siegel and Yee's law firm. But yes, after the rape scandal involving the young woman who now prefers to go by Jasmine, a couple of things happened, right? One of which was that Libby Schaff announced... she called it an investigation. I call it a witch hunt, tomato, tomato, to identify the leaks that were coming out of the department, right? And so under the very wise leadership of our council, we had a conversation about opening our own whistleblower hotline so that officers within the Oakland Police Department who felt like they had information about not just that, but all of the other corruption that we know that remains buried underneath all of the muck and guck of that department could have a safe place with people that they were clear about where our politics lied to come talk about it.
And Sergeant Gant called this hotline.
He came through the hotline, and I'll let Dan talk about the specifics of that when we bring him on in a minute. But that, yes, that is how he got to us, was through the APTP whistleblower hotline.
And when you mentioned Dan, we're talking about Dan Siegel, who is the attorney of Sergeant Gant. He's here in the studio with us. We'll bring him on in a moment. But first, at Dan Siegel's office yesterday, there was a press conference about this claim, and we do have sound of Sergeant Gant talking about this very issue.
I'm kind of torn here this morning because I love my job. As many of you know, I see a lot of reporters in here that I do know that have covered some of the high-profile cases that I've worked in the past. I'm just tired of being made out to be the scapegoat. As you see before you, I am one of the most highly decorated officers at the Oakland Police Department, and I would never jeopardize a case, nor would I jeopardize my own career. I'm a 27-year veteran. Like I said, it's a whole bunch of things that I want to say, but because I am still employed by the Oakland Police Department and I know how things go, depending on what I say, I could be terminated for some of the stuff that I want to say. So I'm going to turn it back over to Mr. Siegel. Like I said, though, I'm tired of being made the scapegoat. I made complaints against officers at the department for looking in my personnel file, for sending racist text messages, and for a hostile work environment. They supposedly conducted those investigations, and nothing occurred.
Again, that was Sergeant Mike Gant speaking yesterday about his claim. Joining us here in the studio is Dan Siegel. He is representing Mike Gant. Dan Siegel is a longtime civil rights lawyer based in Oakland. For full disclosure, he's also a lawyer for our parent company, the Pacifica Foundation. Dan Siegel, thank you for being here this morning.
Sure. Happy to be here, Mitch.
A lot to unpack here. So let's begin by just talking about who your client is. Who is Mike Gant?
Well, you know, as Mike said, he's a longtime member of the Oakland Police Department. He's been a homicide inspector for many years. He's actually one of the most decorated inspectors in the department, has solved murder case after murder case because he's an incredibly intelligent, hardworking, perceptive homicide detective. And now, because he followed his instincts when questioning Brendan O'Brien after the alleged suicide of Officer O'Brien's wife, Mike Gant found himself on the outside, as he says, on the wrong side of the thin blue line.
Tell me more about this investigation into the death of Brendan O'Brien's wife, Irma Huerta Lopez. And this is in 2014. It has been officially, I suppose, ruled a suicide.
By a few people, anyway. But yes, in June of 2014, Sergeant Gant and Sergeant Bassa, another homicide inspector, were dispatched to the scene of the death of Irma Huerta Lopez, who lived, who lived with Officer O'Brien out where the old naval station was in East Oakland. Got there, saw Miss Huerta Lopez laid out on the bed, obviously deceased, and looked around at the physical evidence, including the gun and a couple of casings from shots that had been fired, and thought the whole thing seemed a little bit strange. And then when he interviewed Officer O'Brien, his story just didn't make sense. Officer O'Brien said he had not been there when his wife died, that he had walked 10 blocks barefoot to a gas station to buy cigarettes. A little questioning demonstrated that Officer O'Brien was not a smoker. And all of this started to be confusing to Sergeant Gant, who wanted to pursue it and started to pursue the questioning as he does, closely, professionally. Sergeant Bassa interrupted him, called a timeout. They left O'Brien in the interview room for a few minutes, and then Sergeant Bassa went in to see the then head of the homicide division, Lieutenant Loyce, and Lieutenant Loyce beckoned Sergeant Gant into his office and told him he was off the case, just like that. Would not give him an explanation, and he was replaced with another inspector.
A few things here to talk about, but one I do want to point out and get your response quickly to it, that the Alameda District Attorney, Nancy O'Malley, then also investigated this case, and she ruled it a suicide as well.
Yeah, she did. I mean, I think it would be a mistake to conclude that the district attorney actually did an independent investigation. It appears that the investigation was conducted by Sergeant Bassa and another homicide inspector. There was a coroner's report, which in my mind raised as many questions as it answered, and that appears to have been the extent of it. I don't think anyone really pushed Officer O'Brien about his version of what occurred. And then, of course, as everyone knows, within a year, Officer O'Brien killed himself and left a much talked about but never disclosed suicide note.
It's the suicide note. And again, here's the story even gets thicker. The plot thickens. It's the suicide note that then apparently talks about Oakland police officers having sex with a teenager. We were, for many long time, calling her Celeste Guap, now Jasmine Abuslin. Tell me more about that letter and what we know.
Well, you know, it's a very strange story because apparently, from what we're told, again, we haven't seen it, the suicide note names several officers, at least, who allegedly were involved sexually with the young woman, who, as most people know, was underage during at least some of these encounters. But, again, we haven't seen the note. And the other part of it, which is odd to me, is that Officer O'Brien apparently was not himself involved with Jasmine.
I read that he might have been fearful that she was going to accuse him anyways, even if he wasn't involved.
You know, who knows?
Is that just speculation?
I think it's speculation. It appears that Officer O'Brien was arguing with his wife over his involvement with another woman who has nothing to do with the ongoing sex scandal within OPD.
We don't have access to that suicide note, but I haven't read anywhere that he says anything about potentially killing his wife.
We don't know what it says, and you're right. We haven't heard that he makes any confession about that.
So your client, Sergeant Gant, he was suspended on April 15th?
Of this year, yes.
And the what comes from the city is he was suspended because of a domestic disturbance with his spouse.
There was an incident on April 13 where Sergeant Gant and Mrs. Gant, who live in Hayward, had a dispute. The Alameda County sheriffs were called. They interviewed both of them. Neither had any sign of injury. Neither wished to make any charges against the other. The sheriffs closed it. Then OPD put Sergeant Gant on administrative leave. He's still on administrative leave 6 months later. Through my conversations with attorneys for the Police Officers Association, this is not the type of matter which should result in discipline of Sergeant Gant, nor should it take 6 months to clear. But it's kind of an old story for police and other agencies is when they have a quote-unquote troublesome employee, one way to put that employee on ice is to do what they've done here. Just put him on leave and leave him on leave indefinitely.
Oakland Police Department's gone some time without a police chief. Could that delay all this?
It shouldn't. There's an acting chief. There are people in internal affairs. The city administrator is supposedly running the police department.
Now, the city is not commenting on this. They say it's a personnel issue, and they don't comment on internal personnel issues. In June of this year, Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf and city administrator Sabrina Landreth held a press conference accusing Gant of having his girlfriend prepare homicide investigation reports for him. Now he was cleared of that from the Alameda District Attorney. But what would you say to him?
I would say, again, this is very contradictory and perhaps hypocritical behavior by the mayor. As you mentioned, Mitch, the mayor's office announced yesterday that they don't comment on personnel matters. Yet on June 12th, when Mayor Schaaf and City Administrator Landreth referred Sergeant Gant to the DA's office for investigation, they did so at a press conference. They did it publicly. They put his name out there, and they made an accusation against him, which turned out not to be true. They accused him of compromising confidential records of homicide investigations. What is true and what the DA found, and which is not illegal, is that a friend of Sergeant Gant's was simply transcribing conversations that were on CDs of calls that were intercepted by the sheriff's department between a subject in a pending case and one of his friends.
And you're saying that's an act of retaliation, then, what the city did, what Mayor Schaaf did?
You know, one of the things I want to do is ask Mayor Schaaf in deposition just what information was she acting on when she decided to hold this press conference. Who gave her that information? Was this something that she initiated, which is possible, or was it something that came out of OPD as part of the retaliation against Mike Gant, simply looking at a way to sabotage his reputation and perhaps also to divert all of our attention from the ongoing sex scandals within OPD. At the same time she made that allegation, she made allegations that there were officers within the department who were exchanging racist text messages, kind of a la San Francisco Police Department. And that investigation and the facts of it turn out that some of Sergeant Gant's former friends and colleagues within the homicide division were sending him racist text messages. Now, on one occasion...
And he's African-American.
He's African-American. Some of these other people are African-American. He fired back at one of them, not with a racist message, but with a message that might be described as a homophobic or sexist message. He was then investigated, and again, this year, over 2 years later, City Administrator Sabrina Landreth has proposed that when he comes back from his administrative leave, he'd be suspended for 5 days. None of the other guys have apparently been investigated or punished, although their messages are far more numerous and far more offensive than any message that Sergeant Gant.
So these are very serious allegations, right? I mean, are you suggesting the mayor is involved in stopping an investigation into another police officer potentially killing his wife?
You know, I would like to suggest that, but there is no evidence that the mayor had anything to do with the investigation of whether Officer O'Brien killed his wife. But, you know, the problem is that the mayor remains an uncritical leader of the Oakland Police Department, and that rather than getting into all the problems that have kept the department in federal receivership for almost 14 years, she defends the department and attacks people whose positions are contrary to her own.
And it might be because of that uncritical eye and the blind defense of the Oakland Police Department that she may have been unwittingly utilized to target Gant. I mean, I don't think we can ignore the timing of the accusation of the racist text messages or the timing of the release of his name and his picture in association with a breach of protocol within the Oakland Police Department, both of which came out of Libby Schaaf's office. And so she was either a knowing participant, right, or once again, she was inept at running her police department. Either way,
because she did make accusations at Gantt, a couple of them.
Yes, she did. And she did it during a time, and how convenient also for the timing of it, right, when the entire city of Oakland and indeed the nation were in uproar about the sexual exploitation of a child at the hands of law enforcement.
Dan Siegel, you filed a claim, which is a step, I guess, before a lawsuit.
Right. We intend to probably file a lawsuit in federal court, which will include both state and federal claims. And, you know, I don't want to get so bogged down in the details or the legal aspect of all this to the point where we ignore the fact that a young woman is dead. And it may well be that her husband killed her, and that senior officials in the Oakland Police Department thwarted that investigation. You know, we may never know how Irma Huerta Lopez died, but we should know, and there should have been a full and fair investigation of that death led by the Oakland Police Department's top homicide inspector, Mike Gantt.
If there's a trial, what would that look like? And this came to a trial. Again, it's a claim right now. Yeah, you haven't filed a lawsuit yet. But if this were to go to trial, then I imagine we would have to hear from city officials about this.
You would. And one of the great things about our trial system is that long before we walk into a courtroom, we will have the sworn testimony of Mayor Schaaf, City Administrator Landreth, Deputy Chief Lois, who was the man who took Sergeant Gantt off the case, and others. And so this is going to be a very... in my view, fruitful investigation.
And Kat, finally, just a little more about this. And as somebody, again, who's been working on policing issues, and normally you're working on issues about police killings in the community. How does this fit into that?
Yeah, clearly this is a little bit of a different role for us to play.
You were at the press conference.
I was at the press conference.
And CBS said, what a strange juxtaposition to have you next to a police officer.
Yes, I found it bizarre as well. But I think it's important for us to clarify, right, that for us this isn't about clearing the reputation of this police officer. This is our continued conversation, our continued messaging about the fact that the Oakland Police Department is rotten to its very core. It's not these individual incidents that we need to be focusing on in isolation. We need to be painting the entire picture, which is why this department has been under federal receivership for almost 14 years and cannot be fixed. And so for us, this is just another example, another way into the conversation that will lead us to the types of radical reform, conversations about radical reforms that we need to take to transform what policing looks like in the city. And Oakland should be the vanguard of that kind of work.
All right. We'll continue to follow this story. Dan Siegel, again, lawyer representing Sergeant Mike Gantt. Thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having me in, Mitch and Kat.
And it's just past 7:28 in the morning. You are listening to KPFA, and this is Upfront. I'm Mitch Jezerich with Kat Brooks. And my friends, this radio program and this radio station are possible because of listener financial support. Now, you'll recall in our last fund drive, we put out an emergency call about our future, and that our future was actually in question. Well, many people in September came through for us in that drive. And, well, my friends, we are still here, so thank you. Now, yes, thank you.
Here for now.
Well, over the next few days, we want to try to create a small cushion or reserve, which is nice because it's not necessarily the emergency that we're in, but we're always on the edge and we want to be able to move forward and make sure that we are still broadcasting really after the November 8th election. And that's really when the real work begins. If you were unable to make a donation in this past September drive, perhaps today you can do it of an amount really of what you find affordable for you, what you find appropriate for you. So what we're asking is that you go online to kpfa.org and make that donation. And once you go to kpfa.org, we'll have all, it'll be easy to make that donation. We'll have instructions and everything. We'll guide you through the process.
And coming up in the second half of the show, we will be talking to Jeff Chang, who is the co-founder of Culture Strike and Color Lines, about this political climate. We're continuing our election coverage, talking about the presidential election, where we go after November 8th, and politics in America as they stand today. That's all next after the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. President Obama is warning that early voting among African Americans is lagging this year and that it threatens Hillary Clinton's presidential prospects. Obama said early voting is up among Latinos, but not among black voters. Obama said people who care about his presidency must understand all his accomplishments are based on his being able to pass the baton to a like-minded successor. An emergency hearing takes place today on a lawsuit filed by the NAACP to stop the purge of voter rolls in North Carolina. The NAACP wants to stop several county boards of election from removing people from the voter rolls through challenges filed by individuals. The lawsuit zeroes in on Cumberland, Moore, and Beaufort counties, where thousands of voters' names have been challenged. In most cases, mail was sent to an address and returned as undeliverable. County boards can accept that as evidence the voter no longer lives there. The NAACP says the three counties in North Carolina are canceling the voter registration of thousands of eligible residents, most of them African-American Democrats, just days before the election. San Francisco City Attorney Dennis Herrera says the state's bail system is unconstitutional and he will not defend it in a class action lawsuit challenging its legality in San Francisco.
If you can pay the amount on the schedule, you get out of jail. If you can't, you don't. That approach doesn't take into account risk to the community, just whether you can pay for your freedom or not. That creates a two-tiered system, one for those with money and another for those without. It doesn't make anybody safer, it's not right, and it's not in keeping with the Constitution.
The group Equal Justice Under Law filed suit in San Francisco and 11 other cities and states challenging the current use of bail bonds in criminal cases. A consumer advocacy group is warning consumers about Anthem Blue Cross. The group Consumer Watchdog says the California Health Insurance Company is misleading several hundred thousand customers about changes in their policies that will leave them paying more for inferior coverage. The group says many people who chose health plans that provided coverage for out-of-network doctors will be surprised to learn their bills are no longer covered. People in the affected Anthem plans will be automatically enrolled in new, more limited plans if they don't cancel and switch by December 15th. The change applies to people who buy their own private health coverage from the Covered California Insurance Exchange. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area, sunny, highs around 70. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, a dense fog advisory in effect until 11 a.m. Haze in the afternoon, high 69 to 74 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandary, more news on 94.1 at 8 o'clock.
It's 7:33, almost 7:34 in the morning. You are listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks. The presidential elections are just around the corner at this election season in the midst of the movement for black lives and so much other political turmoil has unearthed much about America that a lot of people would have probably rather we kept buried. Continuing with our election coverage this morning, we are joined by acclaimed writer and journalist Jeff Chang, who is also currently the executive director of the Institute for Diversity at Stanford University. And he is also recently released a new book, We Gon' Be All Right. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Kat.
Thank you for being here so early in the morning.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Transparency, this is the second time I've gotten to sit down with Jeff.
In two weeks.
It's awesome. Considering the first few months of our relationship, it was people telling us that we should know each other.
Yes.
We finally met. So this is good.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm going to start off kind of sort of the way we started off the other night at CIS.
Okay.
In terms of, these are intense times for the country. I mean, I wake up right most mornings with my head sort of exploding.
Yeah.
What are the potential opportunities mm-hmm. of this time, and where are the potential pitfalls?
I think that the great thing about this particular period
in the midst of all the seriousness and the division and the rancor and the pain, right? I'm just tired. I want this to be over too. There's a bumper sticker that's out there on the road saying "Giant Meteor 2016." Let's just end it all already.
I've been seeing
that for a few months, and I've been feeling like that for a few months. But you know, the opportunity I think is for folks to be able to get in place the kind of grassroots movement that we need to have, no matter who wins. To push the issues that we need to be able to push to the front of the debate here. I think that the last 8 years saw first kind of a little bit of maybe over-exuberance, right, at the beginning of the Obama presidency. And then I think what you saw was social movements gathering as we all kind of came to realize that we needed to be able to do this ourselves. So Occupy, BLM, all of these movements sort of captured people's imagination and shifted the debate. And so we need to be able to keep the pressure up on our local levels, regional levels, national levels. And that's the thing that I think we didn't have in place in 2009 when you started seeing the backlash gathering amongst the Tea Party, amongst the birthers, you know, all of those kinds of things. So that's the opportunity. I'm mostly worried, on the other hand, about the violence that may occur November 7th, November 8th, November 9th, and beyond. These folks have been roused, right? The other side has been roused.
And by these folks, you're talking about this white, organized, right-wing base.
Absolutely.
Right,
the KKK, the white supremacists.
You know, whipping into frenzy, right?
Absolutely. Like, they're talking now about going to Philadelphia en masse, going to Ohio en masse, like, looking at thousands of precincts. Being watchers at the polls. Like, we don't need these folks to be watching the polls in Philadelphia or Ohio or anywhere. Democracy doesn't need white supremacists trying to push folks of color from voting. And so that's the thing that I worry about. And that's the thing that I think that's keeping me up at night now.
Well, and there are white supremacist groups that are actually threatening violence against people of color should Trump lose. They're putting this out there. That's the rallying cry to their base.
Absolutely.
Which is just lightweight terrifying.
It's not lightweight terrifying. It's crazy terrifying.
Right.
I've been looking at Casey Lehman, a good friend of mine, writer who's in Mississippi, wrote, I think, on a post last night that this is like folks who are living on the coast don't understand necessarily how fired up folks are around this.
I think I saw that.
Yeah.
In other parts of the country, they've got their Trump shirts and their Trump hats, and they're like, they're ready to go hard.
This is, and you know, you have people openly talking about revolution if Trump loses. What kind of revolution? I don't know. I mean, this is really
not the kind we've been talking about.
No, not at all. but that's the kind of stuff that keeps me awake at night.
There has been so much racial violence, as we're talking about, and talk of racial violence in what so many insisted on calling, you know, post-racial America. I mean, we all, I think, knew that we were not living in post-racial America. But as I think about this also being the 50th year since the birth of the Panther Party, what does that say about what I think you call it the crisis cycle, the loop that we've been in for 50 years.
Right, that we kind of face down a crisis in every generation, that there's a crisis, there's sort of a reaction, then there's a backlash that organizes. We're kind of in that mode right now. And then there's sort of a dissipation, a kind of complacency that sets in, a softness that kind of sets in around these kinds of things. And then we're right back in crisis. So I think that in so many ways, we're not addressing the real issues. And that's why we keep on falling back into this crisis every generation. What potentially we have the opportunity to be able to do at this particular point is to leave that crisis cycle by saying, here's the issues. These are the things that we've been avoiding. The infrastructure for civil rights has been completely demolished over the last 50 years. We have become much more diverse, and yet we've become much more segregated. The indices of inequality have grown, and still the racial inequality indices are the most wide And that's the front line that we need to be kind of approaching from, right? Racial inequality, in order to get at inequality as a whole. But there's all kinds of justifications and sort of like prevarications that we kind of dive into in order to avoid getting to that particular particular mess that we have to clean up. It's like saying, you know what? I really have to clean my house today, but I think I'll do it by lying in bed for a little while and, you know, and maybe catching up on a few more Z's.
But I wonder if that's where America wants to be. And by that, I mean, we've had sort of two political revolutions in this presidential cycle, right? On both sides. So you had the Bernie Sanders camp, right, which was to the extreme to the left. And they've, of course, got the Trump camp that's extreme to the right. And what it looks like where we're going to settle is in the middle again, right? I mean, Hillary being the, I don't want to call her a balancer, but but in the middle of those two extremes, right?
And the default. It's like the status quo, right? We'll just kind of go back to that,
This thing going. Mm-hmm. So what does that say about our readiness for this change that so many of us believe we need?
Absolutely. Well, I think, you know, and this is going to maybe revive a part of the primary elections that progressives would have liked to have avoided. But, you know, the debate between the Movement for Black Lives and Bernie Sanders was, I think, a really, really important one. And I think that the reason it was so important was because we were sort of in the Sanders movement seeing the revival of an idea of progressivism that has really been in the mainstream of the left over the last century, right? I mean, this is the kind of New Deal type of politics adopted for the 21st century. And the thing that I think so many folks forget is that the New Deal left folks of color, particularly African Americans, out, completely out. All of the laws that we point to as being sort of the drivers of the creation of the middle class in the 50s explicitly excluded blacks. And so, you know, when we talk about recuperating this old idea of the left and not taking into account racial justice, we end up at exactly the same kind of place that we have. And I think that was the critique that the Movement for Black Lives was making of Bernie Sanders. And so I think that particular discussion needs to continue. Again, inequality is...
We faced incredible backlash for that, right? Like,
Absolutely.
Black folks were told, well, he's your ally, so sit down and shut up.
Right. Right,
and this just is from progressive people.
Right, but that's the same thing that happened during the 80s and the 90s. This was the basis of the culture wars. You know, you had liberals siding with conservatives, saying that all of these folks who are fighting for racial justice are about identity politics, and that's bringing the entire left down. And I think that's the debate that we need to kind of resolve in favor of looking at this question, right? Inequality has increased for all Americans. And yet the widest gaps are between blacks and whites. And so if we are taking seriously the facts that are there in front of us on the ground, we have to say that the solutions that would come of trying to resolve these racial inequalities will actually help everybody, right? We have to center race in this. And that's not saying that everything is going to be about race in terms of trying to think about all of this. Intersectionality has to come into play. We have to look at gender. We have to look at sexuality. We have to look at all these different types of ways.
We have to look at class.
We have to look I mean, I think that's it. Everybody has sort of said that class is the thing. But it's a debate between class as the only thing and class as a part, as one of the main parts of all of these other constellation of things that are happening at the same time. So intersectionality, class plus race, class plus gender, class plus race and gender, right? All of these types of things have to be seen. And people who are living at the front lines of those issues need to be taking the lead around that. And I think that's the thing that Bernie, even in his history of being a civil rights activist, didn't necessarily see. And I think that's an important corrective for us moving forward.
And when I said class, too, I'm talking about the potential for there's a opportunity, maybe, right? That if we can read it, and you talk about it in your book, but this, how do we redirect the energies of these disgruntled white people who have really suffered at the hands of, you know, who don't, I was talking to Lisa Garza yesterday, and she was painting this picture, people who don't have grocery stores and don't even have Walmarts, we've got Wally Worlds, right, who lost their farm, who, right, how do we redirect their energy away from, oh, it's the fault of the black president, right, and all of his people, to, no, right, at least on this front line, we're all facing the same issues, and let's build power together.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the main question that we have to kind of arrive at, and we have to get to. You know, last summer before I went to Ferguson, I went to Appalachia, and that's exactly what Alicia is describing. You know, you're talking about rural communities that have experience a lot of the same kinds of issues that impoverished urban communities and suburban communities have faced, right? A disinvestment, a moving out of resources, right? An abandonment. And at the same time, you know, the kinds of issues that folks there are facing have to do with issues of increasing premature death, right? Rising amounts of suicides. It took the movement for Black Lives to push the media, the national media, on this particular question. But now that we've been able to kind of expose it, let's look at what the links are there, and let's rebuild the movement from that kind of understanding.
It is about 7:46 in the morning. You were listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks here talking with one of my favorite folks, Jeff Chang, about politics in America, the 2016 presidential election cycle, and more. And we will continue our conversation with Jeff after a word from Mitch Jezerich.
Yeah, a word from Mitch Jezerich now. Yes, that's right. I'm very much enjoying this conversation, by the way, Jeff and Kat. Just quickly want to remind our folks that over the next few days, we're trying to create somewhat of a small reserve of funds to help bring a sense of stability to this radio station. That's something we haven't had, well, at least as long as I've been here. So,
and that's a long time, y'all.
but not as long as some. So I just want to say to our listeners, if you appreciate the type of show that we're doing today and these kind of great conversations, and if you haven't had the opportunity yet to make that donation to KPFA, and if you haven't had that opportunity to do it in the year 2016, here we are, November 2nd, this could be an opportunity for you right now to join this family. And you can make that contribution by going online at kpfa.org. Again, being November 2nd, a contribution to KPFA could be a great opportunity. You know, it's fully tax deductible, but you got to do it before the end of the year. It's November 2nd right now, so here's an opportunity. So just go online at kpfa.org.
I do think sometimes people forget that we are a nonprofit, right? We're not just a radio station, and that we're a people-powered nonprofit. And so it is by the support of y'all that we get to continue to have conversations like we're having this morning with Jeff, and on Monday with Alicia Garza, and all of the hot covers that we're going to have between now and Election Day. So kpfa.org to make that donation. So November 8th. This will all be over, and we'll all be
Hopefully,
oh my God, right. Well, actually, you know what? Maybe I shouldn't say that, because who knows
who knows?
Will happen in all of the bizarreness of this election cycle. Somebody's going to be president.
Yes.
What should, if you could dictate the first 100 days for either candidate, what would those 100 days look like?
Wow. I don't know that I can. Well, gee, you know, I think that the first step has to be definitely some sort of healing. You know what I mean? There's been so much division, and there's been so much rancor and anger that there needs to be an acknowledgement of. I'm going to flip this word, right? I'm going to reappropriate this word of the silent majority, which is us now, right?
Right?
It's not angry white folks like in the Nixonian days. It's us. It's those of us who are tired of all of this, who have been so beat down by all of this. And the healing is not this thing of like, oh, we're just going to all like kumbaya and everything is good, right? It's going to be like, let's take seriously the issues that came up during this campaign. Sexual assault, right? Racial division, scapegoating, right? Immigration, on and on and on, economic displacement and injustice. Let's take those issues seriously. But in order to do that, let's acknowledge that we all have to be in this together. So there's that sort of thing that I think needs to happen there that I'm not convinced will happen whoever wins. And I would say that there needs to be some sort of massive rethinking of what the agenda is going to be moving forward, in along the lines of what we've just been talking about, right? For me, I think that the things that I would be really most interested in would be looking at the question of resegregation, right? The fact that the divisions that we face are fueled by this unacknowledged resegregation that's happening
all
across the country.
But were we ever not segregated?
Well, I think that there's a lot of places that we're not. Yeah, and I think it's worth it. I think there are a lot of places that we're not, but not ever desegregated, right? But I think that the point that I've been trying to make with this word resegregation is that we did have a consensus at one point to try to move towards racial justice. However fleeting it was, however imperfect it was, and however incomplete that infrastructure was that we began to build, right, out of the 60s into the 70s and the 80s, that's all been dismantled. Fair housing laws don't get enforced. You know, fair lending laws don't get enforced. Peak desegregation happened in the schools in 1989. And since that time, we've been backsliding across all levels towards resegregation in our public schools, even as the kids who are coming up are going to be more and more and more diverse. And that's basically leading us into a situation that's going to be really untenable by the time we get to 2042 or beyond. And so I think that I would say yes and, right? Like, yes, some places never got desegregated, and some places got desegregated and have become resegregated. But the main question is, why is it that we tolerate so much resegregation or segregation, period?
Well, that I think is actually an interesting question to pose, given a lot of the narrative coming out of the movement today, which is that actually integration was not necessarily a good thing for black people, that we actually lost keeping dollars in our communities, and we lost, you know, community structures that had been a huge piece of our survival mechanism, you know, throughout the years of chattel slavery and Jim Crow, et cetera, that at least we had these tight-knit communities. We had safety mechanisms. We had that story that all black people tell. Well, mind you, I'm dating myself. I don't know that they tell it anymore, about if I did something three blocks down the way, right, by the time I got to my granny's, not only did she know about it, but I'd gotten five whoopings along the way. So there was something about that social safety net that got broken during, you know, integration. And then there's also this other piece of the narrative that folks are talking about in terms of self-determined black communities, right? And okay. So I feel like black folks are actually moving to a place of resegregation, for lack of a better word, willingly.
Well, okay, so I want to distinguish this, right? I want to say that we need to desegregate in order so that the resources can be apportioned to everybody in an equal and just kind of a way, okay?
Okay.
I certainly am absolutely sympathetic to the arguments around being able to maintain self-determination, the sort of for us, by us type of ethic, right? I mean, I'm from a community of color as well,
right?
And questions of appropriation, but even more exploitation and extraction come up in culture all the time. But these are also real things in terms of thinking about, like, the kinds of economic structures that have been set up during this time. I don't think that we're completely analogous to Jim Crow days in that regard. I think that things are are a lot more mixed up. But what I'm saying is from a national point of view, we need to be able to free up the resources so that people can all start from the same kind of a place. That's the utopian kind of maybe view of things. And within that, there's a whole bunch of room to get into the nuance of it all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm motivated by the fact that that we seem stuck between colorblindness and wokeness, but that we haven't really moved too far from the colorblindness kind of aspect of things. And
what do you mean by that, colorblindness?
I mean that the idea of being post-racial, that we don't see race anymore, right? Like, we're all Americans together. And from a personal point of view, that means that you're not necessarily seeing me in my full humanity, right? If you are going to tell me, Jeff, I don't see you as a Chinese Hawaiian, I just see you as a person, then I'm insulted because you're not seeing who I feel I am, you know? So that's a personal point of view, but it's translated into hard policy, so that any kind of attempt at racial justice is only seen in terms of non-discrimination, right? That it's only about enforcing colorblindness. And that doesn't help us to get to the point of where we can talk about policy that has been, that would remedy the fact that people, were denied resources specifically because of their race all of these years. We have to be able to get at that. And so that's what I think I would like in the best of all possible worlds if we had like a dream kind of, you know, administration coming into place. That's what I would have liked to have seen happening.
And just in our last couple of minutes, I found it interesting. It seems that a lot of the ballots, a lot of the measures on the ballot, at least locally, are reflective of fights that have been happening in the street.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got stuff about housing. We have stuff about policing. And I don't know, maybe even just a few years ago, I would have thought some of these things were a slam dunk, right? Because we knew that we live in these progressive, radical communities, Oakland, San Francisco, Berkeley. But the demographics are changing,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. We've got a new population. What do you think that could – I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what do you think that potentially means for things, you know, more progressive things on the ballot? And how do you think that shifts maybe organizing strategy moving forward?
Wow, that's a big question.
Yeah, I know. You only have like a minute and a half to answer it. So
thanks, Kat.
Be pithy. Be pithy, Jeff. Be very pithy.
Okay, I don't know.
What's that?
To be continued.
Right on. We've been talking to Jeff.
Oh, we got a lot of time.
We got a lot of time. You gotta finish that one.
Wow.
Changing demographics and organizing strategy.
And organizing strategy. Wow. That's a tough one. That's a real tough one. I think that there's... This could be the first election in which we see, you know, what's been happening in terms of resegregation in the East Bay kind of coming to light. And I mean, San Francisco's kind of already done in that regard.
Yeah.
And I actually don't know what it means in terms of voting patterns. I would hope that folks would be voting their conscience and not their stereotype. Let's put it that way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But I don't know. I think that as we move down the line, we're going to have to definitely be centering working class folks in all of these different types of struggles, and continuing to kind of make the appeals to folks who are, say, homeowners when we're talking about renting, or folks who are. Not in the public school system when we're talking about public schools. We're going to have to make those kinds of appeals based on their values.
Right. And support those folks that are standing their ground in their communities, right?
Yes.
And holding space.
Amen.
for yes. Those of us who've, who, yeah. Okay. Now.
Who was that?
That was Jeff Chang. co-founder of Culture Strike and Color Lines, the executive director of the Institute for Diversity in the Arts at Stanford University, all around fly guy, and he's released a new book, We Gon' Be All Right, Notes on Race and Resegregation. Thank you for joining us this morning,
Thanks so
Jeff.
Much for having me, Kat.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Kat. Great verbal volley there, especially at the end. But the whole thing was deep. I mean, that was pretty incredible. My friends were down to our final minute here, and I just want to remind folks that over these next few days, we're going to be trying to raise a little bit of money for this listener-sponsored radio station to try to put us on firm ground here as we move past this November 8th election. I think to have really important conversations like we just had with Kat and Jeff. And what we're asking you to do is to make a contribution online, really whatever you can afford. It'd be a $5, $10, $15, $100, $1,000. You know, for some people, $1,000 is like a $10 pledge to others. So whatever is appropriate for you, help keep us on the air. Help get us on firm standing here as we move into a really important moment in time for this country and for our community. So hope you'll do it by going online at kpfa.org.
And that does it for today's show. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay tuned for Rising Up with Sonali Kohatkar. You are tuned to 94.1 KPFA in Berkeley.